regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. I don't know if it is allergies or if I'm coming down with something, but man, I woke up this morning just completely stopped up. So I apologize for the scratchy voice and the nasal intonations here. On today's program, we're going to be talking with Brandon Maddox from Silencer Central, a topic I guess best described as living well is the best revenge. You know, we have seen over the, gosh, even going back to the Obama administration, the efforts to debank the firearms industry, right? You remember in the Obama administration, I think it was the Department of Treasury came up with a rule, and it was through the FDIC, that there were certain disfavored industries, right? Among them, the firearms industry. And if banks did business with entities within those industries, the FDIC instructed those banks that, hey, I mean, listen, you are opening yourself up to all kinds of audits, you know, because we view these industries as particularly susceptible, right? So it was, you know, payday loans, I know it was one industry. I think maybe even, you know, pawn shops. But the firearms industry, just broadly, right? So if you are a gun maker, if you're a gun seller, if you're a distributor, if you make accessories, you're still considered part of the firearms industry. And the FDIC basically warned companies, hey, don't do business with these entities or you're opening yourself up to all kinds of reputational risk, reputational harm, and we're going to be keeping a closer eye on you, essentially. So we're going to make you open up your books if you are, you know, allowing these entities to bank with you. Since then, we have seen efforts in Congress to prohibit this practice. We also saw an executive order from the Trump administration that has led to most of the big players in the financial industry to come out and publicly say, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. At the state level, we've also seen states like Texas and Louisiana institute policies that if these financial institutions are discriminating against entities within the firearms industry, that they are not eligible to participate in government bond markets. And it was funny, too, because originally, you know, I saw critics of this say, well, it's not a big deal. It's not going to impact. Oh, it has been a big deal. Texas alone, I think, was instrumental in getting at least a couple of these companies to reverse their positions because they wanted access to that municipal bond market. So we've seen this tug of war going on for a decade, if not a little more. And Brandon Maddox is one of those individuals, works within the firearms industry, who was caught up in this tug of war. But I think you're going to be pretty pleased and amused to learn the latest chapter in that struggle. Take a look and a listen. Brandon, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, you bet. So I've got to ask here, we're almost 3 months into the year. We've had, you know, almost 90 days of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act in effect. And we've seen, you know, the numbers reported by NSSF for January and February, significant increase in the number of NFA checks that have been taking place. I'm guessing the majority of those are for suppressors. Let me ask you, how are things going, you think, here with the zeroing out of the tax on suppressors?
You know, excellent. I mean, obviously, we've seen a large increase. I think that, you know, there's always been people on the fence that didn't want to have to pay a tax to the government. So those people are kind of coming off the fence. I think some consumers, too, they hear the tax stamp went away. And I think that they think that maybe the process went away. So they're inquiring more and more people are kind of coming into the mix. But yeah, so far, so good. I mean, one anomaly we're seeing is like a lot of the lower cost suppressors are selling better than we thought. So from our predictive modeling, just for inventory, it's been off a little bit. I think that, you know, some people think that, you know, because the tax stamp went away, people can afford them. But I think the other thing is there was a lot of discounts last year because things weren't moving very quickly because people knew the law was going to change. So there was a lot of discounts on the more expensive ones. So it makes sense now. It's kind of a discount, if you will, on the less expensive ones. So I continue to probably see that to be a trend that the lower end 22s and maybe even 223s and 30s will continue to probably drive more share than people thought originally.
Interesting. Yeah, and you know, I mean, I think it's fair to say we probably saw an initial surge at the start of the year, that sort of pent-up demand that you were talking about. But I was pleasantly surprised to see that the numbers for February were roughly the same as they were in January. I mean, it didn't look like there was any, you know, tapering off. So are we seeing, you know, again, not just that surge of people who've been interested, but now you're seeing folks who are getting interested in purchasing a suppressor?
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, before we used to have people that would buy like, you know, say 4 or 5 and then just kind of wait it out for a year or whatever. But now it seems like people buy it, like it, then they come back and get another one. So, you know, the timeline, it's gone out a little bit. I mean, I think a truss is like a couple weeks now. So it's spread it out a little bit. But, you know, we have some inventory things, you know, trying to get some products, you know, some of the more popular Simulter Codet Airs, the specific models we've had trouble getting. But other than that, I mean, it feels like most manufacturers stay caught up, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and obviously, you know, this has been a huge benefit to the industry. There were some challenges in recent years to the industry. And one of those challenges has been, you know, big financial firms debanking companies, not providing services. We saw this going back to the Obama administration, where the FDIC basically told banks, hey, you know, if you're doing business with some of these industries, boy, I mean, you know, you're opening yourself up to all kinds of audits and whatnot. And, you know, even after Parkland, I think we saw, you know, pressure from gun control groups for banks to not do business with the entities within the firearms industry. You've experienced this firsthand, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, me being kind of naive when I first started, I didn't realize that it was a thing. But our first building, you know, because I started Simulter Central really from home-based and then just worked events. But I went to start to get my first building. I approached Wells Fargo, which is where I banked personally and also with a business. And I told them, hey, I want to buy my first building. I can't remember what it was. It wasn't very expensive. And I was like, I'll put my house up as collateral. I owned 100% of my house at that time. So I was like, let's just borrow against the house. And they said, well, we can't get, you know, an appraisal quick enough on the house. Let's just do a business loan. And I was like, okay, sure. I've never done one of those. Fargo said, we're unwilling to bank you because you're in the firearm space and because of the name of your business, you know, Simulter Central could be, you know, potentially offensive to other customers. So yeah, they were pretty much unwilling to work with us at all, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. Since then, I believe Wells Fargo and others like, you know, JP Morgan, have come out and said, okay, we're not doing this anymore, right? We've changed our policies. Did you ever hear back from Wells Fargo? I mean, have you attempted to do business with them since?
Yeah, that's a fair question. No, I have not. And who knows? They may have changed. I know that JP Morgan in the past has told me they wouldn't, and now they will, because we're, you know, talking to them about some things now. So you're right. I mean, I think the thing that worries us is, you know, we've maxed out the largest bank in South Dakota. We've sort, you know, it's a privately owned bank, the largest bank in South Dakota. We've sort of maxed out their capacity. So really you have to go to the next tier. And the problem is most of the next tier banks are saying now publicly that they'll work with us, but you just worry about in 3 years, if it does change with a, you know, administration, do they then kick you to the curb? So it's sort of a risk we're taking. I mean, it's hard to know what to do, honestly. I mean, I'm trying to convince them to put in the contract that if they do want to debank me, they give me 2 years to kind of figure it out and find someone else. So it creates more problems than I think people realize when, you know, because before I thought, well, there's plenty of banks out there, I'll just go to another one. But now that we've maxed out the largest bank that's privately held in South Dakota, the only option really is the bigger, you know, more public long.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Brandon, you kind of broke up a little bit. I think I might be having some trouble with my internet here, but hopefully that'll get stabilized in a second. But there is, so you haven't done any business with Wells Fargo as far as, you know, going to them for lending or anything like that. But I understand that, that there is actually a transaction that Simulter Central is going to be doing that does involve Wells Fargo. Can you talk about that?
You know, probably one of the largest buildings in Sioux Falls. You know, most people don't realize that Wells Fargo from a bank is actually chartered in South Dakota just because of good banking laws here in the state of South Dakota. So even though Wells Fargo has their headquarters, U.S. headquarters in Charlotte, their charter is really in Sioux Falls, but they had a large presence here in the past. But we, as of yesterday, bought their largest call center that they had in Sioux Falls. It was 112,000 square feet. You know, had enough stations for 800 employees. I mean, it's a big, big facility. So, you know, my realtor was concerned they may not respond to our offer. So we originally put the offer in LLC I created so no one could tell who owned it. I did have trouble getting them to respond to my offer. So then, oddly enough, I went to the person that's over all of Wells Fargo for South Dakota. And he honestly was the person that told me they were unwilling to work with me 14 years ago. So it's kind of interesting that now we're buying their largest, you know, building in town that they don't need anymore because they're, you know, they're not using the call center. I don't know if they sent people home, but they basically closed it down. It's been for sale for a while, but no, we're excited to be, it's actually right next door too. So it works out perfect. They were great neighbors. Anytime we had an event here, they would never let us park over there. So it's good to just kind of, you know, have that behind us and be able to own the property next door. Honestly, our goal is to bring more firearms manufacturers to South Dakota. There's a lot on the western side of the state in Sturgis. So we're going to try to get more here. So the goal is to build some infrastructure for some manufacturing and hopefully recruit some more firearms manufacturers here to Sioux Falls.
I was going to say, so what are you going to use that, 112,000 square foot facility for? What's going to be going
on? Yeah, I think we'll probably... Yeah, good question. I think we'll probably just tear it down, honestly, and then rebuild it just because there's a lot of tax incentives right now for, you know, manufacturing and bringing business back to the U.S. So I think we'll probably tear that down, rebuild a whole new sort of like a manufacturing facility, and then try to recruit other firearms manufacturers to Sioux Falls.
That is that's really exciting to hear. And I got to ask, so you said that you went to the guy who 14 years ago told you and began to do business with you. Did he remember that conversation? Or did you remind him of that conversation?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Did he see the irony in this at all?
I hinted to it. Yeah, he must have because, you know, I had heard there was a bid on the property next door and it had been for sale for a while. So I put in a much larger bid than they did. And they wouldn't even respond. Couldn't get a response out of them. So I was like, I insinuated, did you guys figure out it was me? And he didn't want to sell it to me because I deal with firearms, you know, kind of like we had 14 years ago. And then I'll give it to him. He was actually helpful in, you know, spurring conversation through corporate or whatever to respond to our offer. And they ended up, finally selling it to us. I think once I put a magnifying glass on it, put a light on it and made it pretty clear that he, you know, they were willing to work with us. But yeah, no, I do think, especially in South Dakota, because, you know, banking obviously is a huge employer in South Dakota. But when I first moved here, you know, 25 years ago, it was pretty much one of the largest and kind of one of the only major employers here in town. Mm-hmm. So it's cool to see it switch. I mean, it's a good reminder to areas that just because one industry is prime one day, doesn't mean other industries in the farm specifically could come up, grow and actually be a huge employer here. I mean, you know, we've got close to 200 here in Sioux Falls. So we're trying to grow. And so it's nice to kind of have the real estate next door. Now we'll be up to about 20 acres here right by the airport.
Wow, that's amazing. So do you think that your business was the reason that they didn't respond to your bid? Do you think that actually played a role?
Maybe, you know, maybe. I don't know. Sometimes they're just a big bureaucracy. Who knows? I mean, yeah. Like I said, I used the LLC that they wouldn't know who owned it intentionally to try to cover it up. But yeah, I mean, the honest truth is I offered $200,000 more than the other buyer because the realtor, you know, gave me a good idea what the other bid was. So I thought that was significant enough to get their attention. And honestly, it wasn't. I had to go up another $200,000. So I went $400,000 more than the other bidder. So, I mean, you hate to have to pay more because you're in the firearms, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. Well, listen, I hope that you'll keep us up to date on what's going on with that space and the efforts to recruit more fire manufacturers into South Dakota. I mean, give us your elevator pitch for companies that are, you know, maybe looking to relocate out of anti-gun states or looking to expand their operations. What makes South Dakota such a good fit for the firearms industry?
Yeah, good question. So, of course, we have no income tax. I mean, we always rate as like one of the lowest cost of living. So it's good. It's great to raise a family here. Very safe. You know, I've got two young daughters. Loved it. A lot of very pro-business people. Also, I think it's really easy to find employees in this area because people love hunting and the whole shooting. I mean, I don't think we could have even started Silencer Central here had it not been for the, you know, the hunters, the ranchers, the farmers, a lot of people who hunt and shoot. So it's easy to find employees because of that. Again, no income tax, you know, not a lot of bureaucracy, red tape. And I feel like everyone's pro-business. So if you do hit up, you know, get into an issue with government, typically you can approach them and they're willing to work with you and help you work through it. So, you know, I'd say the only negative is it's sometimes hard to get as many financial incentives from South Dakota because we don't have any income tax. We don't really have a whole lot of taxes. So it's hard to give as much, but I would say definitely give a hard look at South Dakota. I think it's a perfect place to start a firearms business or even relocate one.
Yeah, well, and I would say the zero income or the zero income tax is actually a benefit in and of itself, right? I mean, that's
Sure.
A big break.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so the other thing I was going to tell you, Cam, is you gave me some feedback last time we talked that I need to do more regulatory work on deregulation. I want to let you know I've done that. So I got a law passed in South Dakota that removed silencers from being a prohibited weapon, worked very closely in Kansas as well, testified there, have our lobbyists working on HPA. So I appreciate that feedback. And I want to let you know I took it to heart and we've been working harder on that.
I was going to bring up the fact that Governor Roden signed that bill deregulating suppressors. I'm so pleased to see that. Thank you for all your work. And in Kansas as well, I'll be honest. I've got a friend, Rebecca Schmoe, who's a state representative there. Oh, cool. And Rebecca had actually reached out to me a couple of months ago and asked, do you know anybody in the suppressor space? And so I gave her a couple of names. And I'm really pleased to see that, that's taken off in Kansas. I live in Virginia, where they tried to put a $500 tax on suppressors this session. They kicked that off till next year, but I'm concerned that that's coming back. So, anything that we can see around the country, these efforts to, improve freedom and make it easier to own these items, I'm so thrilled to see that, and I'm really glad that that your work has been so successful in that space. So thanks, Brandon, and please keep it up. Come to Virginia if you can, because I think we might need your help next year.
Yeah, totally. No, I agree. That's a tough one.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Brandon, thanks again for joining me on the program. I know it's a very busy time for you, but always love talking to you and hope we get a chance to do this again very soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, Cam. Appreciate the opportunity.
My thanks to Brandon for joining us on the program. Looking forward to having him back again soon. And if there are more stories like this to come, we will certainly bring them to you. Right now, though, let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story from CWB Chicago. Man who robbed three people in 2 hours will serve about 10 months in prison after racking up credits on an ankle monitor. I have to say, I understand individuals getting credit for time served if they remain behind bars. Let's say, bond is denied and they're in jail for 6 months before they go to trial. In some cases, longer than that, but let's just say 6 months. So they get convicted, they get sentenced to 4 years in prison. Well, you knock 6 months of that off because they've already spent 6 months in jail while they were waiting trial. Okay, I understand that. If you're on an ankle monitor, though, you're not in jail. You're out and about. And we know that ankle monitors aren't monitored 24/7. We know that, people can violate the terms of their release. Nothing happens to them. So why should they be racking up credit for time spent behind bars when they're not behind bars? In this case, it was a 22-year-old Jacob Sickle. When prosecutors asked a Cook County judge to detain him as a public safety threat after charging him with three different armed robberies, the Cook County judge instead sent him home on that ankle monitor. Now it's 2 years later. According to CWB Chicago, Sickle pleaded guilty last Thursday. Man, thanks to the credit that he earned while wearing that monitor, he only has about 10 months left to serve behind bars after being sentenced to 6 years in prison on three counts of armed robbery. He had already accumulated 788 days of sentence credit on the monitor. And as CWB Chicago reports, after applying the state standard 50% sentence reduction to his six-year term, roughly 308 days remained. Which, by the way, a standard 50% sentence reduction. So you get sentenced to 10 years, but you do five. That's standard, right? I don't get that either. According to the website, the robberies occurred on a Monday morning in February of 2024. Sickle and an unidentified accomplice, working their way across the south side of Chicago for about 2 hours, targeting people sitting alone in parked vehicles. One man wore a black mask, the other wore a white mask. Starting about 5 o'clock in the morning, pair held a gun to a woman as she sat in her car, demanded her valuables. Short time later, they robbed a man a few blocks away. At 7 o'clock that morning, they took an iPad from somebody. Within 20 minutes of the last robbery, Chicago police saw a stolen Kia that was believed to be connected to the crimes. The driver then crashed that vehicle while trying to avoid a traffic stop. The two men got out and started running. The driver, who apparently also brandished the gun during the robberies, escaped, but Jacob Sickle did not. He was apparently still carrying some of the second victim's property when police caught and arrested him. And the arrest report says that he is an admitted member of the 12th Street Players street gang in Berwyn, Illinois. So despite being an admitted gang member, despite being caught red-handed with the stolen property, judge in this case said, yeah, he can go home. He can go home. And as CWB Chicago reports, under Illinois Safety Act, defendants on pretrial monitoring receive day-for-day sentence credit, whether they're confined to their home or out during the 2 days per week of essential movement that the law allows. So this is the direct result of Illinois Democrats' soft-on-crime policies. You get arrested, you are not dangerous enough, I guess, to be held without bond, but dangerous enough that you need to be monitored. And while you got that ankle monitor on, and you're in your home, and you're watching Netflix, and you're making yourself dinner, you're ordering Uber Eats, you're, you know, your girlfriend comes over, you have all the amenities that your home has to offer. And you can even leave a couple of days a week. You can go grocery shopping. You can go to the mall. You can go, you know, to the post office, whatever you need to do. You got 2 days a week to do it. The law still treats you like you're in jail. I think that's absolutely absurd, as is the fact that a guy sentenced to 6 years in prison is only going to do 10 months. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. From Albuquerque, New Mexico. Now, the headline reads, man accused of attempting to shoot and kill friend's ex-girlfriend. There is no mention whatsoever of the defensive gun use in the headline here from the Albuquerque Journal. It's crazy. The defensive gun use did make the lead sentence of the story. Police arrested a man accused of trying to shoot and kill his friend's ex-girlfriend in early March, an incident that ended in the friend's death after the victims returned fire in what police say was self-defense. Jeremy Munoz, 46 years of age, facing 3 counts of attempted first-degree murder, 2 counts of shooting at or from a motor vehicle, tampering with evidence, reckless driving, larceny, nearly a dozen other charges. In a pretrial detention motion, prosecutors said Munoz endangered the public with his indiscriminate gunfire. The man who shot and killed Munoz's friend, 41-year-old Sean Martin, has not been charged. Albuquerque police are investigating that as a justified homicide. So this all went down early on March the 4th, about 12:45 in the morning. Officers dispatched to the 5300 block of San Mateo after getting a call from a man who said his friend had been shot in the chest by somebody in another vehicle. That friend, again, Sean Martin, he was taken to a local hospital where he died of his injuries. Police searched his vehicle, which had a single bullet hole in the driver's side door. They found drugs. They found a pair of binoculars. They found a metal baseball bat. Officers then learned that it was Jeremy Munoz who called 911, but he was not near the scene when police arrived. He did not respond to calls from law enforcement. When police tracked him down, he said that he'd been walking in the area when Sean Martin told him that he'd been shot and asked to be taken to a hospital. Munoz said he didn't know who Martin was and then changed the story. So I've known him less than a year. And then changed the story again before ultimately stating that, yes, he was with Martin before the shooting. So police then used phone records, automatic license plate readers to determine where Martin Munoz had been at the time of the shooting. And they learned that Martin had been texting his ex-girlfriend. So then officers talked with her. And she said, yeah, he had been stalking, harassing, threatening her for weeks. The night of the shooting, she told police that Martin had chased her as she tried to ram his vehicle into hers. And they were able to get video showing the two vehicles in a high-speed chase for several minutes. At least 8 gunshots were heard in that video. Detectives learned that Munoz and Martin fired at least 14 shots at this Hummer where Martin's ex-girlfriend was in. The ex-girlfriend and other people in the vehicle drove to a friend's house. As they left the area, Martin approached the vehicle. At one point, one of the people in that Hummer shot at Martin And what they told police was self-defense. At that point, you know, again, they've already been trying to get away from this guy. 14 shots have been fired. This guy pretty clearly posed a physical threat to everybody inside that vehicle, including the ex-girlfriend, who apparently was the intended target here. So now, again, Jeremy Munoz facing counts of attempted first-degree murder, two counts of shooting at or from a motor vehicle, tampering with evidence, reckless driving, larceny. But the main individual who perpetrated this attack was shot and killed in what police again believe to be a case of lawful self-defense there in Albuquerque. Now, I might have put something about that in the headline of the story, but whatever. There is your armed citizen story of the day. And finally, on to our good deed of the day. This from, I want to make sure that I get this right. WAAY in Alabama. Good Samaritan saves man who fell into Big Spring Creek. You can see the surveillance, at least a still frame from the surveillance video from WAAY of the Good Samaritan in question, who came to the aid of this elderly gentleman who had fallen into the creek. John Roberts from Huntsville, Alabama, said it happened Friday morning. He was driving through downtown. He works as a utility locator, and he says he always keeps a close eye on his surroundings. And he says, as I'm driving down Church Street, I saw an older man. He's walking, and he's getting close to the water, and he kind of caught my eye and attention. Roberts said he couldn't stop right away, but he did turn around to check on the guy, and by the time he got there, the man was seconds away from falling into the water. He said he fell and was on to the races from there. So I sprinted over there, and he was in the water. He was screaming, asking for help. Water above chest level, but the guy was breathing. Roberts ran over to the edge, able to pull the guy to safety. He said, by the time I pulled him out of the water, Huntsville PD was pulling in. And first responders took over from there. Robert says, you know, listen, mistakes happen. Accidents happen. You need an arm or a shoulder to lean on sometimes. He says, I'm just grateful that I could be that person. So the elderly gentleman taken to the hospital to be checked out. Conscious when first responders arrived. So it looks like things are going to be okay. Could have been much worse had Roberts not been there to save that guy. And so, again, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing for a stranger in need, John Roberts in Huntsville, Alabama, we thank you for your very, very good deed. And that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I do want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. I am intending to be here tomorrow if my voice holds up and I can speak without sounding like I'm doing my best Bob Dylan impersonation. Diana Mueller, got to be with us. Women for Gun Rights. They're doing some interesting new things, and we're going to be talking about it with Diana on tomorrow's Bearing Arms Cam & Company. Be sure, though, to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day today. We are keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. We've got new anti-gun machinations from Senator Elizabeth Warren, who is taking aim at your ability to purchase ammunition as well as military-style assault weapons, quote-unquote. Yeah. That story, more on what's going on legislatively at the State House in state capitals around the country, litigation, and even taking on the Second Amendment revisionist history that we're seeing from the anti-gunners. All that and more, again, at BarryNarns.com. If you like what you see, but also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member, just go to BarryNarns.com/subscribe, use the promo code FIGHT, you get 60% off your membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, you'll be supporting the work we're doing at Bearing Arms, and I want to thank you for that. Have a great rest of your Monday. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe.